This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Part of the reason I'm moving out of Maryland, you know, because they want to tax me to death and control my life. So, yes. Anyway.
And they want to tax all those cigars you'd like to buy.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Chuck Brown of Education Policy, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mikey.
Do you know who Chuck Brown is?
I don't believe I do.
He was this, famous, the godfather of go-go here in D.C. And you are Mr. Go-Go. You're always on the move, Rick.
I like the go-go's.
Yeah, the go-go.
Remember Belinda Carlisle?
No.
Oh, she did this great single in the 80s with, they had a globe spinner.
Oh, right.
Heaven is a place on earth.
Oh.
It was very catchy.
Wait, what does that have to do with go-go?
She was a go-go.
Oh, okay.
She was like the lead singer of the Go-Go's when they were cutting the soundtrack for Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Your pop culture knowledge is just amazing.
Well, but I didn't know Chuck Brown, so I was just trying to get back in the game.
All right, you're good. It's all good. Rick, I've not seen you in a long time.
I know, baby.
I know. I mean, briefly out at New Schools.
That was very brief, and you wandered off. I was like, where the hell are you?
I always do that. I did not make it for the late night
stand-up routine. Yeah, you were busy trying to shake money out of people's pockets?
That and sleeping.
Oh, Mikey.
It was on the West Coast. It was late. But I heard the acoustics were difficult. This was at the New Schools Venture Fund conference. Rick was hosting stand-up.
Difficult is a nice word for peanuts parents. It sounded like that first time we interviewed Loveless on the podcast.
Yeah, you really? Well, you know, Rick, you were kind of mean with some of your jokes, so maybe it's just as well.
that's why I write them down and put them in the blog.
Exactly.
Just in case anybody couldn't hear them.
You don't want to have to actually say them to somebody's face.
Oh, I'm happy to do that too, but I just don't want any miscommunication when I'm giving people a hard time.
All right, listen, we got lots to cover, and producer Joe has a plane to catch. So we're going to keep rolling. We're going to play Pardon the Gadfly and have Amber's Research Minute. So let's get started, Ty, with Pardon the Gadfly.
In a Wall Street Journal editorial yesterday, Senator Lamar Alexander asked President Obama to hand over responsibility for funding education to the states and have the feds take on the burden of paying for Medicaid. Is Alexander onto something, and does his grand swap stand a chance?
Reagan proposed this in 1981. It's a nice idea. It's not going anywhere. We could talk about it.
Thanks, Rick, for throwing cold water all over this. Is this how your stand-up routine went, huh? Is this why
the idea that you're going to get, anybody to vote, essentially, when you say you're handing over to education to states, part of what you're doing is you're asking members of Congress to vote to zero out IDEA. You're asking them to vote to zero out Title I.
Right.
Ain't happening, people. That's just not going. And the idea that you're going to actually move all of Medicaid onto the federal books isn't happening, partly because you've got all kinds of interstate kind of questions based on how they've operated in terms of Medicaid eligibility. In theory, it's a perfectly fine idea, but it's not going to go anywhere.
And if you dive into his article, one point that he's making, I think this is important, is that Medicaid spending continues to rise through the roof and that it is putting a lot of pressure on everything else at the state level. That's been happening for a long time. It's particularly acute right now. In Ohio, our Ohio folks have been reporting about just huge increases in the number of people on Medicaid. Partly that's because of the recession, partly that's changes in rules. But that puts a lot of pressure on education spending. And that's one of the reasons why we've both been arguing that we are in a new normal in terms of education spending for the long term.
Well, part of it is, it's the way the Medicaid funding works is given the federal match. The problem is, every extra dollar you spend on Medicaid only feels like 50 cents to the legislators. And every time you cut a dollar out of Medicaid, it only feels like 50 cents in savings. So this is kind of the famous one-way ratchet. On Medicaid, education, you get a different dynamic. So it actually makes a ton of sense to do the swap. It's just that politically, you couldn't get, the House freshman to vote to zero out or to dramatically cut Title I or IDEA. So the idea that you're going to actually get majorities in both bodies to kind of do that as part of the swap is, I think, unrealistic.
Okay. Mark Rick down as a naysayer. Topic number two.
Newly released NAEP science data show the gap between minority and white student performance is narrowing. Is the U.S.'s achievement gap mania paying off?
And by the way, I would say, Rick, that this is a consistent trend across basically all of the NAEP tests on most subjects, most grades, at least, fourth and eighth. Big gains at the bottom end of the spectrum. Low achievers making big gains, minority kids, poor kids, all making big gains. Not so much for high achievers, for middle class kids, for white kids. The achievement gap is closing.
Yeah.
Are you ready to celebrate?
There's two questions. One's the empirical question of how much confidence we should have in this.
You're going to throw water on NAEP now, too? What are you? You believe in nothing?
So let's just stipulate. But let's
next, you're going to come out against apple pie.
But let's just stipulate.
Which, by the way, is not on my new diet right now, so I'm against it myself.
But let's just stipulate for the moment that the gaps are closing, which is, given that we've spent 10 years and all our energy and all our public dollars and all our philanthropy geared on this, I'd like to think that we could actually close the gap some. The larger question that's concerned me is whether that ought to be the sole objective of a free country system of schooling. So it's not just, can we manage to narrow the gap if we put all of our energies towards that? Mm-hmm. It's, is that price too high to pay in terms of both what we're foregoing for other kids and of the ways we're narrowing the school reform agenda so that we deal out so many families and supporters who we actually need to support it for it to, you know, maintain momentum going forward.
It's an interesting thing, though. You know, I was interviewing Michael Horn recently just about his book that now seems kind of old, but with Clay Christensen on disrupting education. And, you know, one of the things they argue in the book is that, look, the education system has really risen to many challenges over the course of history. We said, hey, we want you to Americanize citizens. And back then, by God, they did it. You know, we said we want you to get more kids into high school and they did it, you know, and now we're saying we want you to close these achievement gaps. And look, we're actually getting it done. I mean, isn't that some cause for celebration? I mean, look, 10 or 20 years ago, I would have been cynical to say none of this stuff's going to matter. We could do all the policymaking in the world. Nothing's going to have an impact on these scores. We're actually having an impact.
I mean,
all right, well, again, put Rick down as a naysayer. I'll be the glasses half full guy in this one. All right. But I agree with you. It's not everything we want. Topic number three.
Earlier this week, Fordham's Adam Emerson criticized a wealthy Louisiana school district for changing its mind about participating in Governor Bobby Jindal's school choice program over concerns about the burden, financially and otherwise, of taking in lots of poor kids from failing schools. Does this district and its parents and taxpayers deserve to be berated?
I should say, Rick, I have berated districts like this before. Of course, this was before I moved to Bethesda and in the catchment zone for the least diverse school in Montgomery County. But what do you think about this? I mean, this is classic hypocrisy. I mean, a lot of these people in the suburbs, they are Republicans. They vote for school choice types of people, and they don't want school choice.
Actually, I mean, I think first off, I think that's a misapprehension. Most suburbanites and middle class families aren't particularly supportive of school choice. I mean, you can get Republican legislators to vote for school choice plans, but it doesn't actually score them any points back home. They're doing it because they've been told it's the right thing to do. You know, these families and Zachary, they played by the rules, right? They bought houses where they paid a premium for access to good schools.
Good schools meaning schools that don't have poor and minority kids in them?
Schools that, according to the way Emerson wrote it up, are, I guess, achieving well for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. I have zero confidence that it's because they're necessarily instructionally terrific. But for whatever reason, they bought access to these. Other folks did not. A perfectly legitimate way to say this is, you know, if these guys are fine, allowing voucher programs to operate and voting for them so that private schools can spring up and families can have more options, that's swell. I don't see why that should mean that families which paid full freight and have been engaged in local schools need necessarily to throw those doors open to families who have not paid for that personal seat license.
Yeah.
And in fact, in today's accountability environment, I got to tell you, given kind of gap closing focus, that as soon as you start inviting in kids from C, D, and F schools, your school risks getting labeled as failing to make AYP or some, you know, variation on it, that those kids are very well might get more attention than kids who are already at that school. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me perfectly reasonable for these parents to be skeptical.
Yeah, and look, speaking personally, we moved from a diverse place, Tacoma Park, to much less diverse Bethesda, partly because in Tacoma Park, it's complicated. I mean, they're doing a hell of a job, but they have to serve a population that's much more academically diverse, and they're under a lot of pressure to meet those AYP goals. Over in Bethesda, the kids are going to pass no matter what, so they can focus on other things.
So, I mean, it seems to me that actually this kind of criticism is accurate. If anything, the lesson is folks in Zachary should start telling their state rep, don't vote for choice plans. because all it does is open us up to this kind of abuse. So if anything, it actually is going to narrow and undermine the Coalition for Choice.
All right, but so are you saying all the talk about getting rid of a zip code education where you know where a kid gets to go to school depends on where they live and all of that. You know, there are a lot of people in the choice movement say we got to blow up zip code education. You're basically saying what? That's silly, that's naive, that's...
Yeah, it's naive, it's anti-American. It argues with the fundamental basis of school choice, which is that parents are self-interested actors who are going to do what they can to make sure that their children are well treated. Now, you can certainly erode a zip code education with virtual delivery. Charter schools start to blur the zip codes. But the idea that we should try, that it's a good strategy to guilt people who have worked hard and bought homes into giving up things that they have paid for and worked hard for their kids for, because we think it's selfish, is, if anything, more likely to cause middle class and suburban voters to oppose school choice than to change their minds.
All right, thank you. Rick Hess in favor of gated communities and gated schools. But I might be.
So I'm in favor of something.
You're in favor of something.
But you it's ironic. I'm in favor of it, but you live in one. So
well, I don't know that your neighborhood in Arlington is
pretty diverse,
exactly.
Baby.
Let's look at the numbers.
In your forthcoming book. I think we're one of those 20% kind of your tipping point places,
all
right?
All right. Well, but okay. I'll give you that. All right. That's all the time we got for Part of the Gadfly. Now it's time for Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
Do you believe in zip code education?
I can see both points, but I'm probably leaning more towards Rick on this one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, so basically, look, parents want to buy a house in a suburb where there's not a lot of poor kids. That's their right. We shouldn't give them so much grief.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
It's part of the reason I'm moving out of Maryland, you know, because they want to tax me to death and control my life. So,
yes.
Anyway.
And they want to tax all those cigars you like to buy, Amber.
Usually, Fordham is kind of on the side of this kind of, you know, careful respect for families and limited government and taxpayers.
It's a tough one. It's a tough one. Okay, Amber, what you got for us this week?
New study out by Tom D. examines the first-year impacts of the S School Improvement Grant, the SIG program, on low-performing schools in California. D analyzed approximately 28 schools that were situated right above and below the eligibility cutoff for SIG funds. What's this design called, Mike?
Discontinuity.
Regression discontinuity. Woo, boom. 82 of these schools received SIG awards. On average, each school received a SIG grant of $1.4 million, or roughly $1,500 per pupil. Most SIG schools, that would be 48, underwent a transformation model, which meant they had to replace the principal and do some other stuff. 27 chose the turnaround model, which required replacing the principal and at least half the staff. Remainder chose the restart option. They were not included in the study. Bottom line, D found that the SIG reforms raised a school's score on the California Academic Performance Index by an astounding 34 scale points. Before SIG, the average SIG-eligible school scored roughly 150 points below the state performance target of 800, which implies that SIG closed the gap by about 23%. Woo, so digging in a little bit. D found the most improvement in turnaround schools, which I just said, they were where you replace most of the staff. He also found most improvement in the lowest achieving schools. Again, makes sense. He didn't find any significant impact in the worst of the worst schools. Conducted a gazillion robustness checks, meaning he scrutinized his data to try to punch holes in it, including a lot of attention to non-random sorting. So the idea is, you know, could the SIG program have attracted or repelled certain students? Anyway, results held up. He ended up doing some other sort of comparisons and basically concluded that SIG turnarounds are cost-effective relative to expensive class size reductions, generating half of the achievement gain associated with Project STAR, but doing so at a third of the cost. I was kind of scratching my head. California received $416 million in round one SIG, $129 million in cohort two so far. So cost-effective is sort of a relative term, right?
Class size reduction
really,
is really
expensive.
Last
point, you know, obviously this is short-term impact. You know, we don't know whether the results are going to hold in the next year or two. We don't know if they're going to disappear. We don't know what happens after the SIG funds run dry in 3 years.
All that said, I don't think any of us expected these kinds of big impacts, did we? I mean, we published articles by Andy Smerick and Ed Next and other places that said, hey, we are skeptical that this stuff's going to work.
I've had this conversation with Tom. I'm massively skeptical still.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an external validity question, right? I mean, A, if you give somebody $1.5 million, You know, these are schools that are frequently scoring 20s and 30s. So a 23% bump means you go from 30% of kids proficient to 34, 35% kid proficient. If putting $1.5 million more in, shaming you in the newspapers, a la Figlio and Green in Florida with kind of school labeling,
right.
Yeah. The extra attention and support that went along, the fact that these were actually schools which, right, these were competitive, offerings of school improvement plans. If you do all of this, and you can't pick up 4 or 5 points an assessment, then I think it's really kind of funny.
But it still works, right?
But what's Mike? I mean, if you give somebody lots more money, right. lots of support, lots shame money. Them in the paper, and their test scores go up a smidge,
right.
I mean, if that works, then I guess a lot of stuff works.
Well, but what then Arne Duncan would say, we should keep funding the SIG program. We should keep doing this. It's working.
Well,
I mean, help me understand. Are you saying that eventually, it's not going to work over time. Eventually, the money runs out.
I'm saying that if you keep pumping additional dollars and you keep shaming schools, you can move up test scores a little bit, and maybe you can keep moving them up. And that seems to be. I mean, this is part of what I've criticized about the Obama administration strategy, is that there seems to be a notion that we've got to keep finding new dollars to pump into these systems.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I mean, I've never argued that spending another $100 billion can't move up test scores a little bit. It's just a question of whether it's kind of good bang for the buck. And it's a question of whether this is being caused by anything unique to the SIG program, or whether it's a fact that these guys, because remember, this is a regression discontinuity. So it's this class of schools, mm-hmm. and we don't know what's going on with this class of schools that are being affected. So
broadly they're firing half their teachers and they're replacing their principal, which is kind of a big deal, right?
Which is great. So if you're firing half your teachers and replacing your principal, mm-hmm. I've long suspected that this would actually be a helpful thing.
Yeah.
But I would imagine others would say, look, what this shows is that all those other attempts before, reconstitution, restructuring, all these attempts to close down failing schools, fire the staff, restart them, they didn't work because they didn't have any money attached to them. If you do those things and you attach a bunch of money, you can actually get some achievement gains. I mean, what's wrong with that interpretation?
It's a viable interpretation. So what that means is, if you don't then continue to upsize SIG to cover all schools, we'll do the effect. So at these schools, once the money runs out,
right.
do you see kind of achievement fall back to where it was prior?
Right.
Which would suggest that this isn't a particularly,
sustainable.
Or interesting intervention.
Right.
But it's better than reducing class size.
Yeah. Yeah. Ooh, what a comparison that is.
I know. I love that as a bar, right? The least cost-effective thing anybody can imagine becomes, right. It's better than that.
All right. That's all the time we've got for this week. Thank you, Amber. Thank you, Rick. Until next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C., For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.